I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome to The Connection. Human rights lawyer Brian Stevenson has dedicated his life to representing prisoners on death row. He wrote in his best-selling book, Just Mercy, that each of us is more than the worst thing we've ever done. His book was made into a movie starring Michael B. Jordan. He's the founder and executive director of the Equal Justice Institute, dedicated to greater fairness in the criminal justice system. He has won cases argued before the U.S. Supreme Court, including banning mandatory life sentences without parole for crimes committed by children 17 and younger. Brian Stevenson has received many awards and honors for his work, including a MacArthur Genius Grant. His institute recently won the 2025 Stockholm Prize in Criminology. His brother, psychologist Howard Stevenson, has dedicated his life to building racial literacy. These are the skills to negotiate and navigate dangerous interactions, heal from race-based trauma, and challenge injustice, whether personal or political. He's the co-founder of Lion Story, integrating his research into curricula for educators, health workers, and people in the criminal justice system. Howard Stevenson is professor of urban education, Africana studies, and human development at the University of Pennsylvania, where he is also the executive director of the Racial Empowerment Collaborative. Now, we have invited both brothers to join us on The Connection today to talk about their work and to get their perspectives and insights on the troubled and turbulent times we are living in. An overly long introduction. Welcome, Brian Stevenson, to The Connection. And Howard Stevenson, nice to have you with us as well. I should say Howard is sitting next to me.
Hello. Hello, Marty.
Let me begin at the beginning. The two of you were born in Milton, Delaware. I grew up in Delaware, and I think for people that don't know the state, there's Northern Delaware and Southern Delaware. And when you and I were kids, Southern Delaware was largely segregated, either by law or just by practice. And Brian, let me just start with you. What was life like for young Brian Stevenson in Milton, Delaware?
Well, it was very racialized. We grew up in a county where the schools were still segregated. There were no high schools for Black people when our dad was a teenager. Mm-hmm. And in the poor, racially segregated kind of village that we lived in, most of the adults didn't have high school degrees, not because they weren't smart or hardworking, but there were literally no high schools for Black people in that county. When our dad was younger, when that generation was younger, we were kind of at the forefront of integration in the community. Howard went before me. There was a period of time when integration in the schools was voluntary. So the colored school, which I started at, didn't formally close until I was in the second grade and Howard was in the third grade. Our mother, because she was from Philadelphia, really didn't think that that one room schoolhouse with really dilapidated conditions was conducive. So she tried to get Howard into the public school before integration fully came. And that came with all kinds of consequences. And, you know, one of my earliest memories was my mom taking me to the schoolyard because the white kids would chase Howard and he was directed to run to a certain place of the schoolyard. And she would literally tell me to get on the car, climb over the fence, and to stand with him and fight these kids who were targeting us. Wow. And so from the very earliest days, it was very racialized. The entire community was Black. The church was Black. The social setting was Black. And it shifted when we were kids. Integration came to the schools. Little League became integrated. We started interacting. But I don't think there's any way you could characterize our growing up without a deep focus on the history of segregation, sure. Jim Crow, racial division.
I mean, you lived it. Howard, I'm curious, and I read a little bit about your family. Mm-hmm. So how did your family create a kind of feeling of safety and security so that you, the two of you, and you have a sister, could navigate in this world and figure out, you know, how to belong?
Yeah, well, the funny thing about that story of the fighting in the playground is before I did have a friend named Jose Santiago in the first and second grade, But some, and he was amazing because he was huge, and we never lost a fight when he was around. But right. He was part of a migrant family that had to go down south, and our parents explained that to us. And so my mother would bring Brian at lunchtime, and he was smaller than Jose when Jose was gone. So that's important to know in that regard. So we had to fight
right?
no matter what. But my mother was a very direct person around making sure that we stood up for ourselves. And my father had his style. He was more like a spiritual focus. He believed that, you know, we should pray for people if they mess with us. My mother said, you could knock them upside the head to protect your brother and sister. And so they both believed in standing up for your beliefs, your faith. Don't let anybody just mess with you. But what we call now racial socialization is a protective strategy for families. Right. And preparing their children for a hostile, racialized world.
In fact, in a TED Talk, you described your father being more like Martin Luther King Jr., mm-hmm. and he found great solace in the church, and as you say, a more conciliatory person, although we mm-hmm. don't want to undermine what King actually did, mm-hmm. whereas your mom was more like Malcolm X, more confrontational.
In a caricature kind of way, yes, because my father was feisty too. He was. They both had the ability to not let anybody mess with them, and so we have stories. They just had different styles and how they did it. Yeah.
This TED Talk also, you say about your mother, and I'm quoting here: "If you haven't been cursed out by my mother, you haven't lived."
Yes, and it's actually we watched her, and Brian has a story. Where we both know that when we're going to the supermarket, it was stressful because of the way people would look at us. And my mother was not, she was different than other folks. We would walk through the store and run. It felt like to us we had to stay behind her because anything could happen. And if anybody messed with us, she would just stare at them until they stopped staring. Wow. But in many respects, the way that she let us understand, it's at the conveyor belt was sometimes the way that folks in the store would retaliate and disrespect. And Brian told a story once of remembering, which I had forgotten for 20 years, when my mother would take the person behind the counter would disrespect her by taking the change and slamming it on the counter. And we would wait in line until people waited. I didn't even remember that. I'd forgotten that. I remember when she would be angry when the person behind the counter would take the food and throw it into the bag in a disrespect. And that's how they got cursed out. Because once that happened, it was over with. And she was brilliant. It would take 35 seconds, I think, Brian, before the person would be down. They could not withstand. It was awesome to watch her do that. And at the same time, we would be stressed.
But what you're both describing, and Brian, going back to you, is the kind of, I guess, subtlety, for lack of a better word, but the kind of subtlety of racism, how someone puts money on the belt at the cashier counter.
I mean, it's interesting because, you know, my mom's mom, my grandmother, was, you know, born in Virginia. She lived in the Jim Crow South. My grandfather, they were born and raised in this Caroline County, Virginia. Their parents were enslaved. So they understood all of that reality. But my grandmother was courageous enough to leave, go to Philadelphia, and start a life there. And so my mother never got socialized around all of that bigotry. And so she had a different attitude, a different orientation. And I think it did help us to have in our household someone who thought differently about how you navigate these things. And there were times of conflict and tension. When I was 8 years old, you know, we didn't go to the doctor. We didn't go to any, that just because of the segregation, it was just something you didn't do unless you absolutely had to. But I ended up going to the doctor and they said I had to get my tonsils taken out. And the hospital in our community, Milford Hospital, had been segregated for a very long time. It was like 1968 and it was starting to change. But on the day that I went there to get my tonsils taken out, they had all of the black kids in the hallway. They didn't put any of the kids in the room, and there were other black kids, and there was a little girl who had fallen, and she had was bleeding. And when my mother went into that space and she saw all these kids not being attended to, it enraged her. Mm-hmm. And she really started demanding some response and got quite confrontational with the nurses. And my father came in, and he was really worried about what they were going to do to me when they took me back behind that door.
Right.
And you could see them in conflict with one another. and he was asking my mom to stop. And it was, they had the same concern, but he didn't trust them to not retaliate against me because they were angered and provoked by my mother. And it just kind of revealed the complexity of what is required. And all of this, of course, is an unnecessary burden. No parent should have to figure out the right approach to protect their child from racial animus and bigotry and harm just because their child is black. And my parents had these different strategies, as Howard has talked about, but it doesn't come without cost, without tension, without conflict, without anxiety and stress, and that stress we would have in the stores with our mother and in a lot of other places where these issues would play out was just part of our childhood.
Did it make you, I'm looking at you, Howard, did it make you close as there's a sister, but as brothers? Did you feel, I mean, it was kind of like us maybe against the world?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we had friends, and as we got older, my mother and father bonded together to create a choir, a community choir, which started with just Brian and Christy and our cousin Teresa in front of our church. And but by the time they were done, within a year, and lasting for years after, we'd have 30, 40 student young people from around this wooded area. They bonded together, but in many respects, navigating these spaces, we were very close, and we wouldn't go very far away from each other. And there were rules about it's okay to hurt somebody that messes with your brother and sister.
Yeah, and you're the oldest
I'm the
by a
oldest,
little
yes.
more than a year,
15 months,
so
yes.
close in
Yes.
age.
I can just add to that
Sure.
that I was the beneficiary of having an older brother. I mean, from the moment I was born, Howard was there, and there was never a moment when I knew that he wasn't watching out for me and protecting me. We had two rooms in our house. My mom and my sister slept in one room. Howard and I and our dad slept in another room. We had two bunk beds, and we would push the bunk beds together, and there was a crack in between these two bunk beds. And initially, we would both kind of, debate who was going to have to get in the crack. But there was a point at which I kind of liked sleeping in the crack because I had my brother on this side, my dad on this side. So we were really close, kind of physically and emotionally and psychologically. And it did, I gained more from that because even though we're only 15 months apart, there was never a moment when I didn't feel like I had a big brother watching out for me.
Well, that's really, really nice. Let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with Brian and Howard Stevenson. Yes, they are brothers. We've been talking about growing up in Southern Delaware. Each of them has gone on to have really extraordinary careers. Howard Stevenson is a psychologist, Brian Stevenson, a lawyer, and they're here to not just talk about their lives growing up, but also to talk about this world that we're living in now and some of the lessons that they have learned from the work that they have done. Much more after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you were going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money Podcast from NPR.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. We are talking about, or we will be talking about, finding our shared humanity in these turbulent, troubled times. Our guests are Brian and Howard Stevenson. Brian Stevenson, a civil rights attorney, founder and executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative. Howard Stevenson is a psychologist, executive director of the Racial Empowerment Collaborative at the University of Pennsylvania. I think it's so easy to feel anger and despair today, and certainly the times that you grew up in, I grew up at the same time as well, to feel that anger and despair. And yet, I feel like both of you have lived your lives around this issue of hope. and I don't want to overstate it. I'm looking at you, Howard. Mm-hmm. But I mean, to be a psychologist, you have to believe that people can change and can do the sort of hard work of looking inside and find some way to better themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and actually spending a lot of time working with children and families who've been physically and sexually abused, you get a sense where people are in dungeons. They feel a sense of darkness. But watching them come out of that after experiencing some very horrible things, that they can still find their voice, still find light. It's quite remarkable in how it changes those who help folks. You can see a lot of things are possible. So it matters when you spend time to listen to folks' stories, even if they're very tragic. And my brother has done that especially. But hope comes from witnessing crazy things that have happened to you get changed. So it changes you too.
You have written about hope and anger and despair and injustice. Brian Stevenson, fear and anger can lead to injustice. I mean, certainly that is how dictators take power and get people to turn against each other, by using fear and anger.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we're seeing that now all across the world. There's been an emergence of what I call the politics of fear and anger. And when you look at the 20th century, the worst moments in that century were the moments when fear and anger prevailed and really horrible things happened. The Holocaust is a consequence of narratives of fear and anger reigning in Germany and then throughout Europe and causing the death of millions of people. We had a Rwandan genocide just 32 years ago, where a narrative of fear and anger spread through that country and hundreds of thousands of people were killed. We're in the midst of, I think, a political moment when there are a lot of people preaching fear and anger. And of course, the challenge is that when you allow yourself to be governed by fear and governed by anger, you start to tolerate things you wouldn't otherwise tolerate. You start to accept things you wouldn't otherwise accept. So many of the behaviors that are problematic, which Howard has to deal with, are rooted in a kind of anger and fear that is governing people's actions, even overriding their better judgment. And so this hope question becomes important, because I think that hopelessness is the enemy of injustice. It is the opposite of injustice, and it's an orientation of the spirit. And I think the benefit of at least our upbringing was that it was very much rooted in the Black experience in this country. We're not that far away from our enslaved great-grandparents. Our family line is pretty short because my great-grandfather was 50 when my grandmother was born. She was 40 when my mother was born.
Right.
You know, we were 30. My mom was in the 30s when I was born. And so that narrative is very connected. And so we've been fortunate to understand what enslaved people had to endure, survive, to prevail. And it was a hope narrative. And those who survived lynching and terror violence, going to Philadelphia from Virginia was an act of courage and hope that you could step away from that lynching violence. You know, even navigating segregation like our father did, you know, despite that constant humiliation, that constant exclusion, to still hold on to your dignity, to believe that you were worth the respect of other people, that you were not inferior to anyone, was rooted in a kind of hope. And I think that's the legacy we were given. I've been living in Montgomery now for close to 40 years. And I am in this city where a generation ago, people put on their Sunday best and it would go to push for the right to vote and the right to participate and not be excluded. And they'd be on their knees praying and get battered and bloodied and beaten. And they would go home, wipe the blood off, change their clothes and go back and do it again. They did so much more with so much less. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it would seem ungrateful. It would seem dishonest to not recognize that I have to be hopeful about what I can do in this moment, despite the ugliness of this moment, given what our ancestors have done before.
Indeed. And I'm thinking, Howard, you're a psychologist, so you've had to deal with human beings and human nature. I mean, how much do you think trauma is part of what creates fear and anger?
Oh, it's a big part. And it doesn't go away unless you address it. Even when we forget our trauma, sometimes it shows up in the most difficult or challenging spaces. There's a way in which When we tell our stories, though, and we actually can access what trauma has done to our bodies, to our thoughts, to our feelings. One argument, growing up in a black church where you don't always know what the future is going to be, that sense of faith has led you to believe in things that you can't quite see yet. There's also a reality of facing things that are hard to know, right? Knowing our history is difficult, but it's actually salvific in its capacity to heal us for future kinds of struggles. And so the idea that we can get over stress and trauma, one argument for why we want to stand up to injustice and hate is that we get a chance to heal from the traumas that we are still going to face, even if we are afraid to.
Yeah. You know, I'm thinking, and Brian, I'll go back to you, and I'm thinking of, you know, the museum that you, the Legacy Museum that you helped to found, the National Memorial for Peace and Justice, why it's so important for us to understand, deal with, contend with our history, sort of like you were saying, Howard, for us human beings to understand where we came from is very helpful, and it's good to tell those stories. And yet, you know, there's pushback, as we all know, there's pushback about our history and, you know, erasing people out of the history books or putting in people who don't actually deserve to be there. How do we contend with that?
Yeah, I think it is the critical issue of our time. I mean, we're in the midst of a massive narrative struggle in America. Who are we? What kind of identity do we want? What kind of people do we want? Do we want to ignore the past, pretend like we've never done anything wrong, or do we want to be more honest in how we cope? And the truth is, we have a long history of racial injustice in America. We did terrible things to indigenous peoples when Europeans arrived on this continent. Millions died as a result of forced relocation and disease and horrific abuse. Our Constitution, which talks about liberty and justice for all, we didn't apply those concepts to Native people because we created this narrative of racial difference where we said, oh, no, those indigenous peoples, they're savages. And that narrative is what we then used to justify 246 years of slavery. And I continue to believe that the great evil of slavery wasn't the bondage and the cruelty and the forced labor. It was the narrative that was created to justify enslavement, because people who enslaved other people didn't want to think of themselves as immoral or indecent. So they made a false narrative up where they said that black people aren't as good as white people. Black people are less capable, less worthy, less human. And that narrative was so powerful that it survives the Civil War. It tears down Reconstruction. We abandon a commitment to the rule of law. So for 100 years, black people are pulled out of their homes, beaten, drowned, tortured, lynched on courthouse lawns. When Octavius Cato in Philadelphia tries to register people to vote, he's assassinated for he's challenging that narrative. And then we codify all of that. And we're still in the early stages of reckoning with that history. And we've made some progress and saw in 2020 people out on the streets and really beginning to understand how we can't run from this history. And now we're in a political moment when there's a very, very strong counter narrative trying to make everyone stop talking about this history. So, yeah, I totally embrace what my brother does, because I think that truth and justice, truth and reconciliation, truth and restoration, truth and redemption is the only way we will actually become the great nation that some of us want to be. We cannot hide from this history. And when you commit to truth telling, things begin to change. And I've seen this in Germany, where if you go to Berlin, where I was just a week ago, the whole landscape is about truth telling about the horrors of the Holocaust. There are no Adolf Hitler statues.
There are none.
In Berlin. Students there are required to study the Holocaust. But when you come here to this country, here we are now, naming military bases after the very architects, defenders, and authors of white supremacy, racial hierarchy, and division. So, yeah, I think that is the challenge that this nation faces. And I had hope, and I still have hope. But my brother has two kids. My sister has two kids. I love them all. And I would love for their children's children to live in a world where they're not going to be presumed dangerous and guilty. But we won't get there if we don't re-engage with this truth-telling about our history. And I think there is fear about it, but I absolutely have seen the power of confronting history. And we see that every day at our sites where people come in and they come out, I think, changed and different because of that truth-telling.
And that's Brian Stevenson. He's a civil rights attorney, also with a psychologist, Howard Stevenson. They are brothers, and we are talking about our history. And let me go back to you, Howard, because something that you have really sort of built your whole life around is this notion of racial literacy, which is, when you think about literacy, it's narrative, but it's more than that. I mean, I think of it as literacy is understanding someone else's experience. It's about empathy. How do you define it?
I think about literacy as three things. It's the capacity to read, to recast, and resolve. And to read is to notice what's happening in the world. So we go through the world sometimes through stress and trauma and not aware of how it affects us. And so reading is noticing what's happening in other people, but also in yourself. Recasting is this idea. Let's say I'm overwhelmed by the hate that is going on, the tragedies that I see. But how can I reframe them as possible instead of impossible? Maybe not great, but at least not horrific. And we can teach folks through mindfulness approaches how to do that. We know one of the consequences of hate on even young people is that it affects health outcomes. We see this in young people. We see this in adults, whether it's online, whether it's in your face in the streets, whether it's through social media. And so the more that we can help folks understand the impact and notice what impact it has on their bodies and thoughts and feelings, the more we can help them change. Now, resolving is how do I make decisions to stand up against things that are harmful to me and to others? And that voice is a proverb that we use for the lion story. It's called "The lion story will never be known as long as the hunter is the one to tell it."
I love that.
And so how do you fight injustice but heal at the same time? Because it's draining to stand up to hate. But with the skills that we teach, we can help people to take care of themselves even as they find their voice to stand up to that hate.
Let me go back to you, Brian, and I'm sort of toggling between the law and psychology here. But, you know, my question, I guess, to you as someone who's sort of in this fight is how resilient, how strong is our judicial system? We have, you know, policies being dismantled. We've got immigrants being deported without due process. We've got Marines, you know, in the street chasing down people to deport them out of the country. We've got an administration that has defied judicial rulings, or if not defied, certainly dragged them out and not responded to them. Do we have the kind of system that can withstand all that and hold our democracy together?
Yeah, well, our system is managed by people. And when we have courageous people, when we have people who are committed to the rule of law, when we have people who are willing to stand up, even at some personal peril, the system is strong enough. When we don't have those kinds of people, we'll see lawlessness prevail. And our history is very revealing on this. After the Civil War, you have 4 million formerly enslaved people emancipated. You know, the Congress says we're going to create a 14th Amendment to guarantee equal protection for these formerly enslaved Black people, a 15th Amendment to guarantee the right to vote. And Black people did something remarkable in American history that I don't think gets acknowledged enough. These were 4 million people who had been brutalized and cruelly treated and abused. But instead of choosing revenge and retaliation against former enslavers, they chose America. They chose citizenship. They chose to start building schools. That's when historically Black colleges and universities are created. They started building churches. They started building families and communities. And for that short period of Reconstruction, they thrived, and things were moving forward. And then the courts, the judiciary, retreated. And they preferred this narrative of states' rights and racial hierarchy over the rule of law. And so we abandoned the rule of law throughout most of the first half of the 20th century. It was a return to the rule of law in the 1950s with the Warren Court that struck down segregation, that struck down bans on interracial marriage, that struck down a lot of the barriers that had held and prevented Black people from the same opportunities. And we've been in that moment, and now we're at this decision point on whether we're going to hold on to that commitment to enforcing the rule of law, even when it's unpopular. I mean, you know, Brown versus Board of Education was a deeply unpopular decision.
Indeed.
Even in our
Indeed.
Community, mobs of white people gathered to try to block black children from going to the public schools. If we had a vote on whether the schools could be integrated when Howard and I were little kids, we would have lost the vote. The county was 80% white, 20% black. We wouldn't have won a vote on integration. It took a commitment to the rule of law. It took lawyers coming into our community. And so I think it is going to be a test for every judge, every lawyer, every legal institution. Are we going to remain committed to the rule of law in this moment when the politics of fear and anger are pushing? And I'll just say history will be watching.
Yes.
I think that we have made mistakes in the past. It frustrates me because, you know, everybody says, oh, if I was alive during slavery, I would have been an abolitionist. Mm-hmm. If I was alive during the time of lynching, I would have been crusading against your lynching. Everybody says, oh, I would have marched with Dr. King on the Eben Pettus Bridge. But if in this moment you give in to fear and anger, you do not enforce the rule of law that protects the disfavored, the undocumented, people of color, people who are marginalized, the poor. If you're not standing on that side, you can't claim to have said, I would have been on the right side in these prior earlier. So that's the test that our generation is now facing.
About a minute before a second break here, Howard. But again, as a psychologist, I mean, what does it take to maybe stand alone, but stand up for things that you really believe in?
Yeah, you have to rely on history. One of the beautiful things of going to Brian's museum is that as much as you're going to see the horror of this country, you realize the power of history as a threat to those who want to get rid of the rule of law. And so people go to that museum not only to see the tragedy of our history, how it's repeated, but also find a call for healing in the process. What is it that I can do? When you see how others have sacrificed, and you realize they did that for us, it changes the narrative of how you want to tolerate hate.
Again, almost up in a break, but you said people seeing history as a threat.
Yes.
How?
Well, it was interesting that in those times that Brian discovered that you change, you want to get rid of knowledge about how people were when they were trying to get rid of this reliance on law and people's rights and freedom. And so history can repeat itself, but if you don't know it, you wouldn't understand why this seems very familiar, what's happening right now.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with Howard and Brian Stevenson. And again, Howard Stevenson is a psychologist. He's at the University of Pennsylvania. Brian Stevenson wrote a book about 10 years ago called Just Mercy, subtitled A Story of Justice and Redemption. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money podcast from NPR.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm talking with Brian Stevenson, founder and executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative, working to find greater fairness in the criminal justice system. He also, as I mentioned, wrote this book, Just Mercy, A Story of Justice and Redemption, and he works representing prisoners on death row. His brother, Howard Stevenson, with us as well. He's a psychologist, and he is professor of urban education, Africana Studies and Human Development at the University of Pennsylvania, where he is also executive director of the Racial Empowerment Collaborative. Brian, I want to just quote something that you write in this book. You say, I am more than broken. And you talk about, again, your work with people on death row, people who have been accused and sometimes found guilty of really terrible crimes. But you go on to say, I began thinking about what would happen if we all just acknowledged our brokenness, If we owned up to our weaknesses, our deficits, our biases, our fears, maybe if we did, we wouldn't want to kill the broken among us who have killed others. Maybe we would look harder for solutions to caring for the disabled, the abused, the neglected, and the traumatized. I had a notion that if we acknowledged our brokenness, we might no longer take pride in mass incarceration, in executing people, in our deliberate indifference to the most vulnerable. How did dealing with people on death row teach you about your brokenness?
Yeah, I think I've been really privileged to do the work I do because I have learned so much. I mean, I got into it because I saw a system that was working so unfairly for people. You know, in our legal system, we treat people better if they're rich and guilty than if they're poor and innocent. Wealth is a bigger factor in assessments of culpability. And then when we add on to that, this extreme punishment of killing people to show that killing is wrong, you see a lot of anguish and a lot of suffering. And I guess the privilege I've had is standing next to condemned people, to hated people, to disfavored people. I go into communities where people are so angry. Yeah. You know, we've gotten bomb threats, I've gotten death threats and all of that. But standing next to someone who's condemned, someone who's hated, someone is disfavored, and pushing for justice, engaging in truth-telling, creates this amazing opportunity to harness the power of grace, of mercy, of love. And you see these beautiful things that come out of it. It's very hard to pretend you're healthy if you're not healthy.
Yeah.
It's very hard to pretend mm-hmm. that you're perfect when you're not mm-hmm. perfect. And the more we commit to that pretending, the less healthy we get, the more vulnerable we become. And so that's what I've learned. You know, when I say that each of us is more than the worst thing they've ever done, I'm saying that on behalf of my clients, but I'm saying that on behalf of everybody.
Sure.
All of us mm-hmm. are more than our worst act. And that allows us to have this opportunity for redemption, for restoration. And it's funny because Howard and I come out of the church from a faith tradition. And, you know, in our community, you couldn't go to our church and say, I want heaven and salvation and redemption and all of those good things. And then say, but I'm not going to admit to anything. I haven't done anything wrong. The clergy in our church would say, no. It doesn't work like that. Mm-hmm. You've got to be willing to confess and to repent. But then they'd say, don't fear it. Because mm-hmm. when you do that, your heart opens up. And that's when grace and mercy and all of these amazing things start to happen. And we have denied this nation the beauty of redemption and restoration after enslavement, mm-hmm. after lynching and terror, after segregation, by resisting the obligation, the need to confess to it, to admit to it, to acknowledge it. And I see the same thing happening in the lives of my clients in this legal system. You know, I don't think, we have the kind of system that should be killing people. I don't think the death penalty is an issue you can think about by asking whether people deserve to die for the crimes they've committed. The threshold question is, do we deserve to kill when we make so many mistakes, so many innocent people, so much bias and all of that? So, I feel privileged to have done what I do. And I learn my clients, many of whom have been so abused, and yet they still have hope, and yet they are still seeking mm-hmm. redemption and restoration. And I guess that's part of the upside of doing the work I do in Alabama. I just believe that if we can find redemption and grace and mercy for condemned people on death row in Alabama, then mm-hmm. we can find it anywhere and everywhere in this country.
Mm-hmm. Howard, as a psychologist,
sure.
So how do you see brokenness? As a psychologist, what is brokenness?
I think when people have gone through trauma, we want to forget, and we want to put it aside and squelch it. And sometimes in the forgetting, we squelch not only the trauma, but hope. And in the process of revealing what has happened to us, and we take out that anger about our incompleteness, our brokenness on other people. So it's not uncommon for people who have been harmed or to want to harm other folks. But the notion around this lion story will never be known as long as the hunters want to tell it. When I actually get to face not only the hope, but the tragedy of my narrative and find that there's there's forgiveness, there's grace, there's options around what to do about that harm, to speak to the offender, to the oppressor, and say very directly that I did not deserve this, and I will not allow it. We teach young people how to say to themselves first, I reject your rejection of me, wherever it comes from. Finding, we use healthy and unhealthy comeback lines so that you could find your voice to notice what it has, how it has harmed you to be dehumanized. And when they find their voice, they walk a little differently. They stand up a little differently. And the way that someone hates on them does not have the same impact. And that could come from the society, that could come from online, that could come from family. When you find your voice, you walk a lot differently. Mm. And you won't just let anybody do or say anything.
You know, Brian, I'm sure you've been asked this before, and you know, I'll be honest with you, I struggle with mercy and forgiveness. I guess we all do. Sort of, you know, who is deserving of that? But I was thinking of, frankly, of Dylann Roof, you know, who murdered 9 parishioners in a church in Charleston, South Carolina. I Googled today, he has never apologized for what he did, never apologized to them or their families, I guess, for what he had done. So I struggle with this sort of mercy forgiveness for someone who seems so unreachable, I guess, so beyond our ability to reach out.
You don't give mercy for someone else. You give mercy for yourself. Huh. Mercy is not something that is really mercy if it's only given to the deserving. That tragedy in Charleston is an amazing book that's just come out titled Mother Emanuel, and it provides the whole history of Charleston, South Carolina, and all of the ways in which that community fostered the kind of animus toward Black people that young man acted on during that really tragic crime. And yet, those Black people in that church almost instantly were prepared to show forgiveness because they understood that they didn't want to be condemned by his violence, condemned by his murder, condemned by his bigotry. I think mercy is something we have to do for ourselves. We have to show it and give it because it's the only way. I had a client, Anthony Ray Hinton, who spent 30 years on death row for crime he didn't commit, 30 years. And on the day of his release, I was talking to him. His release was scheduled for 9 a.m. I got there at 8:30. I said, okay, I'm taking Mr. Hinton out. And they said, oh, you have to wait until 9. They wouldn't even give us the 30 minutes. But we were back there talking, and he told me, he said, Brian, I think I've decided I have to forgive them for what they've done. He said, because when I walk at that door, I don't want to be in another prison constructed by bitterness and resentment. And I think there's so much we can learn from understanding how we knew through the word. I think what Howard does is help people accept that they can't always make the other people not show them hate, but they can create a relationship to that hatred that doesn't destroy them, that empowers them, that allows them. Mm-hmm. And that is what we've been given by our ancestors. My great-grandparents who were enslaved, my great-grandfather learned to read even though it was illegal for enslaved people to learn to read. It was an act of resistance and defiance, even though it could have cost him his life. Right. And in it was this idea that we can transcend, we can transform. And so, you know, these are words we don't use a lot in American discourse. We don't talk about redemption. We don't talk about restoration when we talk about criminal law and criminal justice. We don't talk about recovery and all of that, but I think the absence of those words in our dialogue is part of the problem that we're seeing manifest now, which is so shaped by vengeance and retribution and mocking and belittling and demonizing and making people seem less than people, and the rhetoric has gotten worse and worse and worse. We want to lock everybody up who doesn't agree with us, and that's a recipe for the kind of brutality and kind of injustice that we've seen too often in societies across the globe.
And again, going back to you, Howard, and just the sort of psychology of forgiveness, how that works. Again, you know, people do things that really test our ability to forgive.
Mm-hmm. Yes. But we don't let their definition of humanity shape our view of what's possible in the world. So if you can't see some of the hardest things to go through is to to see that you haven't really forgiven yourself. You're harder on yourself. And you might take that out on other folks. But until you're absolutely able to face the reality that you also deserve forgiveness, that's a hard thing. It's not easy to say that I deserve humanity. My brother tells a story about our great-grandfather, who was the only one to read in the town, and people would come on a Sunday, and he would read the newspaper. And part of the idea of once you actually can appreciate your humanity and that you have something to contribute, you also have to use that for other people in a way that is absolutely important. So it's scary to face that maybe you have options in this regard.
Yeah. You've talked a lot about your ancestors, and Brian, there's something that you said about your grandparents, which is that they believed in something they hadn't seen. And I scribbled that down because how do you believe in something you didn't see? You have to really and truly believe beyond your imagination in a certain kind of way. Flesh that out for us. What does that mean?
Yeah, I'm proud of both my brother and my sister. I mean, the community we grew up in, you did not see achievement. You know, most of the adults worked in the poultry plants. It was a very poor, really rural, really limited. We had neighbors who had outhouses who didn't have functioning water systems. There was a lot of poverty. I don't think either of us knew anybody who was a college graduate growing up. Mm-hmm. And yet we wanted to go to college and we believed we could do it. And so we had to believe something we hadn't seen.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, Howard went on to get a degree in divinity and psychology. I went on to law school. You know, when I got to law school, I'd never even met a lawyer. And it made me initially feel diminished. That my peers had something I didn't have, but thinking about my enslaved great-grandfather who had enough hope to learn to read when it was illegal, thinking about my grandmother who worked as a domestic her whole life but insisted that her children be readers. Our mother was a prolific reader. We couldn't get through her room without stepping on books and magazines, which was very atypical in that community. But she had that hope. And even though we didn't see a lot of hope outside our door, we did not see a lot of Black achievement in our community. Our mother went into debt when we were children and bought us the World Book Encyclopedia.
Yes.
And we had those books in our house. Yep. And you could mess up a lot of things, but you couldn't mess up those books. I'm not even sure she ever paid for those books. But, you know, Howard was able to read about the psychologists, even though he hadn't met one. I was able to read about the lawyers. And that was an investment in believing in something. My mother, if you had asked her when we were little tiny kids, could your son be a psychologist and a professor at University of Pennsylvania? Could your son go to Harvard Law School, become a lawyer? Could your daughter be a music teacher? I think she would have said when we were 4, 5, and 6 years old, yes, they can.
Yeah.
And it would have sounded irrational and crazy to anybody she said it to. But that's the kind of investment, that's the kind of believing without seeing that she gave us.
Yeah.
And so that's why I'm unwilling to give up on a world where Black people and brown people are not going to be presumed dangerous and guilty just because of their color. I just refuse to give up on a world where we are dishonest. I mean, I'm preoccupied with this history right now because I've been persuaded that truth-telling and memory is the justice we owe the 10 million Black people who were enslaved for 246 years in this country, the 10 million who endured the immense suffering and constant sorrow of slavery. And when we don't educate people about that, it's not only dishonest, I think it's unjust. Yeah. And so for me, it becomes a justice issue to kind of elevate this history. And I've seen what it's done in our lives, my brother and I's lives, and I know what it can do in the lives of the children that come after us.
Sure.
So yeah, it becomes urgent.
Urgent. Yeah, go. I'm looking at the clock, but I want to make sure you have a chance to talk there. Go ahead.
No, and I say, just like Brian's saying, my parents, they would argue a lot because they were trying to stand up for their own ideas about dignity. But one thing my father constantly pushed, in addition to the fact that there wasn't a lot out there, he wanted us to make sure that we hadn't forgotten where we come from. So the people that we went to church who didn't get to high school, right, he had to follow a play aunt to go up to Wilmington to get to graduate from Howard High School. They all still believe that you're not going to be anything if you forget where you come from. So as much as they didn't have access to the rest of the world, they supported us to get to this other part of the world. And we, if we forget that, we also lose all these rights and privileges and around grace and forgiveness. And so forgetting who we came from and where we came from was another sort of side piece to this conversation about what's possible. So my mother said, yes, we can be and go anywhere, and don't let nobody tell you otherwise. But my father said, don't forget us and how we help to support you to go there.
Well, we have come full circle, and I must say, such a pleasure, frankly, an honor to talk to both of you today on The Connection. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Marty.
Yeah, thank you very much. And again, our guests have been Brian Stevenson and Howard Stevenson. And Howard Stevenson is a psychologist here in Philadelphia. He teaches at the University of Pennsylvania. And Brian Stevenson wrote a book about 10 years ago called Just Mercy, A Story of Justice and Redemption, and he is a civil rights attorney. Well, thank you for joining us today on The Connection. The show airs every Friday and Sunday at noon on WHYY. You can download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. You can also follow The Connection on Instagram, and you can find us on Facebook. Our engineer today has been Al Banks. The show is produced by Debbie Bilder with Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.